So now I propose everybody is closing its laptop because it's now getting fast. We are starting with the lightning talks, and the first talk will be given by Wolfgang Stief. He's introducing the Computer Museum München. And what I understood, it's all about vintage devices and vintage guys playing with vintage devices.
Thank you. Hello. I'm waiting for some slides. So yeah, my name is Wolfgang Stief. I'm from Munich, and I'm heavily involved in something which we call Croy Cyber or Computer Museum München. It started all with Croy Cyber. Markus, can you? Okay. I have lots of pictures, but the first one is a text slide, and I would like to bring this to you. No, he's already on the way. Okay, here we go. Okay, so it started with something which is called Croy Cyber. We have some web page, some Twitter handle, and this was a private collection from first one person, then what was a bit more. It started around 2000. I'm a team member since 2003 there, and we have our focus is on scientific computing. So we are collecting scientific mainframe supercomputers, mostly from Control Data and Cray. We usually don't pay for this, so we get them from universities when they are decommissioned, usually. And during the years, we found out that in Munich there are some more people also collecting vintage computing stuff. Usually not these big ones, but smaller ones. You all know probably a C64 or some Atari 800 or 1040, stuff like this. And at some point we decided, well, let's make some bigger thing together, put all our collections together, and at the moment we are on the way to build up a computer museum, which is more or less privately held, but with cooperation with University of German Armed Forces, Universität der Bundeswehr in Munich. And the nice thing is that, so they have, in the computer science department, they have one group which works on reconstructing old data, how to do this, and from time to time they need some old machines. So we provide the hardware for them, and they provide us with floor space, with air condition, and with electricity, which is quite important because these are the most expensive parts when you collect these things. So the Computer Museum München is 25 members around currently. Not all of them are active. Some are just there because it's fun to be there, speak with the people. I would say something around half of the people are active collectors, all have their own specialities, their own realms, where they are collecting stuff and repairing stuff, all the things. For Croy Cyber, what we have really in focus is not only collect the machines and put them there to view them, but we also want to restore them and run them as they were run 10, 20, 30 years before. Next up, I have some pictures for you. So yes, it's still volunteer, although we have big machines as well. This was a transport we had from Swiss Bank, from Zurich to Germany. We had lots of fun at the Swiss export customs and German import customs. I can tell lots of stories out there in a coffee break probably. This is when we went into our current location, which is unfortunately closed for several years now because the roof is instable. There is some instability there, or at least it's suspected to be some instability there. So this is when we moved from the old location to this new one. This is a former airplane hangar, which is very, very nice, very big, but we have to go out there. The new building is already there. We are currently on the way restoring it, but it's not finished. Plans are for mid-2017. When we will be back in operations. Problem is that there is German government involved, and this makes things very, very slow. But at least it works. Most interesting thing on this picture is the machine up there. This is a tube computer, which is completely self-planned and self-built. It's not finished yet, but I would say 2/3 to 3/4 is already done. This is the biggest complete machine we have. It's a Control Data 960 from 1986. It's in the upper left, or in the more in the middle, it's the machine itself. The most left part with the most right part is the power supply. Then the bigger door is the CPU, the smaller door is memory, and then there is I/O subsystem. And all around, you can see, for example, up here in front, this is a card reader, high-speed card reader. At the back, we have a high-speed chain printer, some controller units up there for the tape drives, which you can't see here. And the black one is a very, very new machine. It's from 1991, I think, from the same vendor, also Control Data. This is the Unix corner with control workstations. So you can see a Sun Enterprise 10,000. Then there is a Create Chain 90 with 132 CPUs, 116 CPUs. And at the very left, there, for example, there is a two-node SGI Origin 2000. This is from the Deutsche Wetterdienst in Offenbach, for example. This is some Create T3D. Six rack is the maximum configuration for this machine. It's not running so far. Involves a lot of cabling. Of course, we have some DEC, which was a very important company during the history. There's a DEC PDP-8 with some peripheral stuff. These are Vexons. We have an open VMS cluster running on this. We have, of course, as I told, some smaller machines. So this is the micro and workstation area of next stations up there, the black ones. At the very back, there is Robotron, the GDR stuff, some Siemens Teletext right in front. All fun parts to play. One very important thing is to have documentation for all this stuff. We have quite some documentation, but not at all for all of the machines. Usually when you get a machine from university, it was running there for a few years, then it was decommissioned somewhere in the basement, and at some point somebody decided, let's put them away, and I know somebody in Munich, they might be interested. Yes, we are interested, we get the machine, but usually documentation was thrown away years before. And this is really a problem. It's even harder right now, because at some point, current supercomputers will also be some museum part. But documentation right now is usually on the web, in the internet, and it's once the machine will be out of business, you can't get from the documentation from the vendor sites. So we are now collecting documentation for current machines in order to have them available once we might get such a machine in the museum. So since we are on a network conference, what about our networks? We have some networks. The thing is that most machines, we cannot choose the network we want to have. We have to take what we get. So we have some vintage stuff, not so vintage stuff. We have network equipment for most of them. The problem is, and that's what my idea is here today, we don't have an idea on how to present network or how to present vintage networks, and you also don't have the knowledge. So maybe some of you are interested or have some ideas on how to present vintage network in a museum, then just in the coffee break, come to me. I'm here today and tomorrow as well, and I'm open to change ideas with you. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Wolfgang. So now we have seen a high-speed card reader. What's the baud rate of this card reader?
Oh, it's 1,200 cards per minute. Oh. So,
whatever this means. Okay. The next talk is given by Moritz Frenzel. It's titled Nesting DWDM Within CWDM. And as the title says, he will tell us how to pimp legacy CWDM installations, or how not to.
So if I get slides, are those microphones working? I think so, right?
Yeah, Markus needs to speed up. You can use this microphone.
Okay, thank you. So I'm Moritz Frenzel. I'm a network engineer for Globalways. We're a Stuttgart-based ISP, and I want to show you a bit about wave dimension multiplexing and maybe how to stack them, and that it's not all about the magic that some vendors might talk about. It's, in the end, it's just physics. So I will spare you the Wikipedia definition. You can read that up if you want to. In the end, what is wave dimension multiplexing? First, you need to understand the concept that light can have multiple colors. We have seen that. We'll just call them wavelength in the WDM market, and that's it. You can join them using a multiplexer, and then you can transport more than one signal over a fiber. That's it, and that's WDM in easy, I guess. There are multiple parts of WDM. We have CWDM, which I assume some of you have known. Quick hands up, anyone ever done CWDM? Yeah, well, it's quite a few. So CWDM, in the end, what most of you might know is that we have a center wavelength range. It starts with 1271 nanometers and goes to 1611. We have a channel spacing of 20 nanometers, so with 1271, 1279, S1271, 1271, and so on. But what we really care about is the filter pass bandwidth. For the sake of this talk, I always focused on things that are typical and things you can buy. There are lots of other variations out there, but let's just stick to what the market has to offer. So we have this 30 nanometers for the filter pass bandwidth. If we were to look at one channel, let's say we take 1511 nanometers, we have a center wavelength, 1511, and we have a channel width of 20 nanometers, meaning our channel starts at 1501 and ends at 1521. But what we really care about is the filter passband, this one here. This is in the end where we can put our light. So we have the 30 nanometers of space where we can put basically any signal, and our filter will allow us to pass any light in this range through it. So if we keep that in mind and go over to dense wave dimension multiplexing, we don't have the center wavelength. We here focus on a center frequency, which is 193.1 terahertz. Yeah, it's also a wavelength in nanometers, but yeah, just for that. We have multiple channel spacings. Most typically is probably 100 gigahertz. You can have 50 gigahertz. You can even go to, I don't know, down to 12.5 or even 6.5, if I'm not mistaken. But also for the sake of what is typical, we will use 100 gigahertz here. Filter passband is a thing that is rather hard to research. It took me quite some time to find some values for that. It's for 100 gigahertz, typically 0.11 nanometers, but we don't need it here. In the end, when we take the 100 gigahertz grid, we have 73 possible channels. And for historic reasons, I think we used channel 20 to 59. There are some from channel 21 to 60. In the end, it was just from back in the day when fiber wasn't as good as it is today. So where we had problems with water peak and whatnot. So typical channel ranges you can buy if you go out there and want to buy a big WDM system, DWDM system, you will get channel ranges 20 to 59 or 21 to 60, depending on the vendor you choose. What does this give us? And I think in the end, what we need to care about are the wavelengths. On the top, we have the CWDM channels. And what I said earlier, or what my presentation was about, is I want to fit DWDM into CWDM. So I will just pick channel 59 here and try to fit it somewhere. So wavelength somehow seem to match with the CWDM 1531. And if we give a closer look here to the 1531 channel and taking care of the passband that our filter has, we can take all wavelength or all DWDM channels with which are in the range of 1524 to 1537 nanometers and put them into this 1531 CWDM channel, which means we can pick choose all green channels and stick them into the CWDM channel. Same for channel 20. Well, we don't have a corresponding CW channel, so we have to maybe look around the other channels we have. In the end, we can take all these channels here and fit them into the 1551 CWDM channel. This is maybe just for something you might want to look up later in the slides, but in the end, for a conclusion, we can go ahead and take channels 59 to 51 and put them into our CWDM 1531 channel, which in the end allows us to, yeah, well, use 8 more channels on our old CWDM system than we were used to. And same goes for 1551. This even gives us 14 more channels. So we have a slight upgrade on that. Whether you want to use this or not is basically up to you. It is for sure just something you want to do in the metro. So please don't go ahead and try to put this on an amplifier or whatever. Also, if you are considering upgrading a CWDM by putting some DWDM in there, please go ahead and talk to your respective manufacturer, because all values I just chose are in the end from either my vendors or from stuff I found on the internet. So you want to go ahead and talk to your vendor. Obviously, stacking multiplexers adds attenuation to the systems. And if you ever are to debug something like this, please don't go ahead and use those cheap power meters, because they will misguide you. They don't have an understanding of what the center wavelength is, what you're seeing there. Please go ahead, use an OSA. They're a bit more expensive, but in the end, that is what you want to do. I think as this is a lightning talk, I will skip the questions and we can talk at the beering or whatever. I'm around for all days, or just hit me up on Twitter or Facebook or IRC, or just pop me an email. So thank you.
Thank you, Moritz. So in the next lightning talk, okay, in the next lightning talk, Jan, I think Czermak,
yeah,
okay, Jan Czermak is going to tell us something about the Turris Omnia router and the corresponding open source project. Yes.
Yeah, so hi, my name is Jan, and I'm here to tell you a short story about the Turris Omnia router. I hope you won't fall asleep before your coffee. So first, let me introduce myself and us. Unlike many of you, I'm not a network engineer. I'm a software developer working for CZNIC Labs. We are R&D department at CZNIC, so it's a Czech top-level domain registry. And we use the money from domains for some interesting projects like the BERT routing daemon or not DNS server, and recently also Resolver. But the project I will be talking about now is the project Turris, which started over 3 years ago, and it's where our story begins. Maybe I'll ask, does anybody in here heard about it already? Cool. Quite many people. So, just briefly, Project Turris was a research project, internet security research project, that was aiming at the end-user segment of the internet, and we wanted to know what happens there, where all those dumb CPE devices are. So we wanted to do some analysis on the devices itself and so on, and we need some powerful hardware that the analysis would be carried on. So we made this thing called the Turris router. It was a dual-core PowerPC device with 2 GB of RAM, running OpenWRT fork with some customizations like automatic updates and similar things. And we made 2,000 of these devices and gave them basically for free, or technically for one Czech crown, that the people don't have to pay, so for free. And in if the people agree that they will provide us some data from the devices. And this device was made completely open, as open hardware that was running open source software. And when we went to conferences with this and talking about the project, many people told us, hey, I want this device, I want to take it home, I want to buy it, where can I buy it? And we couldn't sell it for two reasons. The first one, it was quite expensive. And the second one was that we didn't expect that demand for such a device. So we thought, what could we do about it? So we created a different device. We thought that we will make something cheaper and lighter. So at first we called it Tourist Lite, but then we were able to design something that was even better. And we called it Tourist Omnia. So basically it's better on all, in all the aspects. But about it later, this thing came to life thanks to a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo that started roughly a year ago. We managed to raise $1.2 million. That means it's the same amount as the number of Czech domains. And what's inside this box? As I said, it's completely open, open software, open source hardware. The core is dual core ARM CPU at 1.6 gigahertz. It has 1 or optionally 2 gigabytes of RAM, 8 gigabytes of flash. It has six gigabit Ethernet ports. One of them is directly wired to the CPU and is shared with an SFP connector. So you can plug there some SFP module. Or if you visit the Nokia showcase here, we have there a demo of Omnia running and DSL module. So it's completely self-contained DSL CPE. It has other interesting things, and I hope if it works, yeah. So this is, for many people, the killer feature. It has RGB user configurable LEDs, and that are also dimmable. So it's really cool if you don't like those blue shiny things that shine in your eyes. It's definitely a thing you want to have at home. It has two USB 3 ports, 3 mini PCI Express slots, etc., etc. The software inside is again OpenWRT fork with automatic updates. If you don't want to use that one, you can also, there's currently some upstreaming effort for the vanilla OpenWRT, or now LEDE. And there's also effort to make upstream support for Debian and OpenSUSE. So I think that's all I wanted to say here. And the last thing, if you want to take part in this story, and if you didn't, if you haven't done that already, you can buy it. It's available through retailers like Amazon.de or Alzeshop here in Germany. And it's also available for distributions. So if you're interested about it, just contact me. I can tell you some details. And I think that's it. So if you have got some questions, you can catch me around. If you want to talk about the hardware, software, or if you want to start your own hardware startup, I will tell you why not to do so. So thanks.
Thank you, Jan. So we have two more lightning talks, which I think are not yet on the website, but that's the surprise of the day. The next will be given by Thomas King. You already saw him in the morning. He's with DKIX and will tell you something about standardization of the black hole community.
Thank you. So it's me again. I have been the poster boy for black honing for just some time already. And I will give you an update on what we have done. No, I think that's not my slide deck. Something similar? Yeah, that's mine. Perfect. Do you see the same thing? Ah, we have different screens. I just saw what Marcus was doing, right? It's funny. Okay. I would like to give you an update on what we have done on the black honing side, RFC 7999, and let me quickly introduce you into the idea. Black honing, it was already covered in two presentations this morning. One from KPN, they covered it perfectly well. But let me stress one issue, what we have seen actually in 2014, when black honing was more or less introduced new to IXPs. There, for instance, at DKIX, we were providing the black honing service, and if you as a customer would like to use the black honing service, you had to use a rewriting of next hop IP addresses in the BGP announcements. And that's sometimes quite annoying. So we were thinking about a different signaling mechanisms to use or to trigger a black hole. And during that step, we realized that other IXPs providing this kind of services, and I have a selection here on this slide, have different triggers for black holing. And in the discussions we had with our customers, we realized that it's quite annoying and cumbersome and error prone that every IXP and also ISP comes up with their own solution how to trigger black hole. So we were thinking about how to resolve that issue, and we were finally coming to a solution that is named Black Hole BGP Community. So it's a well-known BGP community that can be used by everyone. And that can be easily implemented in filters and BGP announcements. And though we were talking to the IETF and to Jana about this well-known Black Hole BGP community, we were working on an internet draft with different parties like EuroIX, also with different ISPs like KPN and NTT, and so finally we came to RFC 7999, which just defines a well-known BGP community that can be used for black holing, and that's already available. So actually, it was issued already four, five, 6 weeks ago, and so we were talking to BGP speakers that they support this this black hole BGP community, and here we have a list of BGP speakers supporting this already. So BERT is already, it's also a NICCZ project, by the way. It's already supporting RFC 7999, GoBGP as well, OpenBGPD, Peter is here, thanks for that. XIBGP support that, Quagga, it's requested, but not supported yet. We also have an open ticket with Nokia. What we didn't do yet is we didn't talk to Cisco, Juniper, Procade, and Huawei yet. But Peter from NICCZ told me this morning that they will open a ticket with Cisco, so that we will get support there as well. But if you would like to see that happen, please go to your vendor and talk to them, and please make it happen that they support RFC 7999. If we look on the IXPs and ISPs already supporting the Black Hole BGP community, we have already 44 IXPs supporting this. Of course, DKIX, we were driving that a bit, so we were one of the first supporters. Then we have all the Equinix guys, that's pretty cool. The people from Moscow supported already, and others as well. Also, Community IX, Theo, thanks for that. Thanks for the support. Also, on the ISP side, we have already seen some pickup, especially KPN. thanks KPN, and smaller ISPs and hosters as well, like SUSE11 and Theo, thanks again for that. And Christian from Strato supported that as well. Great, thanks. So what we are trying to, this is actually the purpose of this lightning talk, is that everybody who is providing black holing services to their customers or is using black holing services, please have a look at RFC 7999 and support it in terms of that you honor this well-known BGP community, so that others can easily use your black hole service. So that's pretty much it. Two links to some further documentation here, the RFC 7999, and I have set up a GitHub project where I collect all this this information that is here in the presentation as well. So if you are an ISP or carrier or whatever you do within the internet and you provide black holing services and you you support RFC 7999, please let me know so that I can put it here on the GitHub website so that people can see that this is well supported. So thank you very much again, and a special thanks for all of you who contributed to this effort with comments, with feedback, also with critics, Stefan for instance. So thank you very much for that. That helped really make this happen, and I think that there's something we achieved as a community, that black holing and fighting DDoS is easier now. Thanks.
Thank you, Thomas. So last but not least, it's my exceptional pleasure to introduce myself as the last lightning talk. It's not just me between you and coffee. I will try to make this as quick as possible, but obviously as long as necessary. Okay, here we go. My talk is about a working title, which is APDN for short, or Longer Attack Prefix Distribution Network, and the aim is to motivate you to fight DDoS together. And the point really is, we should do this together. So some sort of background, it's obviously some subset of this audience here feels annoyed by DDoS attacks, and some of them understood that DDoS attacks can't be mitigated locally. I'm pretty sure that most of you understand this. Then we sit together and talk about these issues and what we can do. And some of us are using a service called UTRS. We'll come to that a bit later. And which is quite a nice idea, but we see some deficiency, and especially we are not sure how this service will evolve in the future. When I'm talking about some of us, here are some names. I'm not going to read them. I'll leave the slide for some seconds so you can have a look at it. This list should not be finished, so we hope you see the necessity as well, and we hope you join us in our effort. So what do we want to do? And first, what is UTRS or UTRS? I'm not sure how it's pronounced correctly, but I think it doesn't matter. Who of you has heard of it? If you see the name, if you see the logo, okay, quite some. In essence, it's an open and public black holing route server. You can set up a BGP session with this route server, which is run by Team Kamru, and via that route server, you will receive /32 prefixes, which are currently under attack and where you shouldn't send traffic to. That's the very short message. Currently, I think it has around about 120 participants. Is that right? Okay. And what we've heard in the queue for some weeks, I think some months, are another 100 participants. But unfortunately, there are some issues within Team Kamru which hinder them from bringing up these new peers. Aside that, there are different other issues we see. First, this service is run by one entity, so in essence, it's a single point of failure. If it fails, then your last line of defense fails, which is quite bad. We noticed in the last week several longer outages of this service, which may be due to the reason that the person, which is called John Christoph, who initially developed and invented this service within Tim Cambrew, has left the company. And after that, we have the feeling, by looking at how this is run, that there is not that much effort in further promoting and extending this service. So, which in the end, you see there are no new features. There are many feature requests, but no new features get added to this service. And as we think this is actually a good idea to have some kind of distribution network or black hole route server, we came up with the idea and the vision to develop something on a more resilient, more stable, more global base. So in essence, the idea is to establish a network of currently in the first step of route servers, which distribute prefixes under attack, but not run by a single entity, but run by different local or regional communities. So for instance, DNOC could be a German community who could provide such service, and an LNOC or NANOC could be a community which could run additional node. We have some feature set in mind. So first, of course, we would like to have feature parity with Vue.js, which is very straightforward, very simple. But then the service is missing IPv6 support. Even if you don't see that much attacks on IPv6 prefix today, this might change in the future. Also, it might be a good idea to add BGP flow spec. Also, Markus doesn't like it, but that shouldn't hinder us from implementing it. And of course, we could think about some kind of selective blackholing being supported by such service, which in essence means we just need a solid concept of how to selectively announce or control the announcement of prefixes to the peers via BGP communities. But in the end, there is room for improvement, there's room for ideas, and we could do even better than just exchanging prefixes under attack. We could also exchange attack patterns in the end. But this is some kind of vision, which is, I don't know, 3, 5, 10 years plus or something like that. So this is where this could develop to. To make the idea once more clearer, and afterwards I'm going to formulate a question. Some of you might know or might be able to guess what this question will be. We are looking into a distributed setup. We want this kind of route servers being run in different places, being maintained by different communities, which allow us to spread in a very wide range globally, and which allows us to get in touch with even enterprise autonomous systems or every downstream AS you may imagine. This is only possible if you ask if you have a globally distributed network. And the obvious idea would be to start such an initiative by running what we would call the e-node in the DNOC community. And that would be something new. If you look at the e-node, this is currently what is it? It's a forum where people meet, which is quite nice. But if we would run such a service as the Enoch with the Enoch label, that would be much more. Would require some kind of professional service attitude or however you might call. And the interesting question would be: is this something that you, as the Enoch, could imagine? That we run a service under the Enoch label and start such initiative as the Enoch. And to that question, I would like to have your opinion. So maybe you could raise your hands, or if someone would like to comment, then feel free to use the microphone. But remember, it's coffee time. Sorry? Oh, not only coffee, there are also t-shirts. So. So can you show your hands? Anyone has, or how should we start? So who would like to have such an initiative being run by DNOC? Okay. Who doesn't care? And the remainder is against it. So who's against it? Oh. Two. Okay. So from the hands, I would say we should continue discussing this. And we will. Okay. So thank you very much. We'll probably start discussing this on the mailing list. We maybe come out with a website. We try to keep you informed. Talk to any one of the guys who have been listed on the second or third slide. We can explain you more what we want to do. Okay, that's it for my talk. That's it for the first session. Thank you very much for attending, for participating. Enjoy coffee and see you again at 4 p.m.